When will they? Mm-hmm. What kind of deterrence methods will they try and use? Mm-hmm. How, when, and what locations will they use it from?
According to a lot of reports, Iran didn't use its most modern weapons. It used a lot of the oldest new drones that it's got, and not the newer ones. It used older missiles and so on. So a warning there as well that maybe if you do push the wrong buttons, we will bring out our new technology, which you clearly won't have defences for, because the older ones did manage to get through. Sister Latifa, what are your thoughts on that operation from last week?
I couldn't have said it better. I think there is something that we do need to talk about in terms of the change of the strategic calculus of the region with Iran that has now taken a more aggressive and assertive posture within the region. And that is that it went, as Emin was saying, from a strategic patience perspective, where it was allowing its generals to be killed, or allowing maybe isn't the right word, but it was
tolerating
absorbing the aggressions, the hits, the hits, a little bit like Black Panther's suit, and now you know, unleashing all that force. And it needed to do that, as Emin was saying, because there was a lot that needed to be learnt before they could attack Israel. We need to remember that 6 months ago, it's hard to think now, but Israel 6 months ago was this untouchable, you know, incredible entity in the region, you know, a giant that that nobody dared to even speak against, let alone act against. For it now to be this shriveling entity, rightly so, in its place, is all down to Iran and its change of posturing, which has now gone into the deterrence mode, willing to attack, showing that they are truly the maddest in the room, willing to sacrifice. Martyrs are ready at the borders to go. The people of Iran are waiting for a fatwa from their maraja so that they can go and fight. And if this is the everyday man and woman of Iran, you can imagine the people who have been trained for years watching the massacre of the people of Gaza and the people in Palestine, the humiliation that they have had to suffer for the past 76 years. You know, these are things that are being taught to the people of Iran since childhood. So their love and their passion for the Palestinians exceeds the love of their own nation even. And this deterrence posturing is not a front. They have the weapons, they have the allies, they have built on it for decades, and we've seen that it has had an impact on the region, and it will continue to do so.
And it's interesting because that deterrence, as you mentioned, has been there since before, you know, October the 7th. It was to the point where most of the countries of the region were on the brink, well, I say most, but some of the most important ones, like Saudi, there were reports of normalization with Israel. And all of a sudden now we're in a situation where that's likely off the table. And in fact, countries like Saudi and others, despite their close military ties with the Western nations, are distancing themselves and saying, well, we didn't have anything to do with it. It was only Jordan, from all the countries in the region, which went out of its way to support the entity. Sister Emin, if we could come to you finally, just briefly, I want to talk about some of those countries. You've got countries like Turkey, which, you know, Erdogan speaks about the Palestinians and supports them, and yet hasn't cut ties with Israel, continues to trade with them, send them food and gas and other utilities and items, I believe. And of course, Jordan, as we just mentioned, going even further and shooting down munitions, injuring some of their own people in the process. What are your thoughts on that? Why have they done this? Why are they not still, even after this genocide, cutting their ties with Israel?
Well, to put it very simply, they're allies of the occupation entity. They're allies of the US. They are in the camp of the aggressors. They are normalizers. So, for example, you mentioned Turkey. Turkey is a member of NATO. Turkey is a US ally. Turkey is one of the biggest exporters to Israel. And Jordan, when Ansar Allah was, you know, seizing these Israeli ships in the Red Sea, it was actually through Jordan and Saudi and the UAE that these routes were being rerouted through. So, and also with Jordan, we can't forget the Iranian attack. It positioned itself with the aggressors. It helped in downing the missiles that the Iranians were kind of inflicting on the occupation entity. And I think even prior to this war, they house the imperial powers in the region. They give a leg for it to stand on. Look at Western bases. Where are they all surrounding? They're surrounding Turkey, the Gulf states. And so really, we understand that all this these pro-Palestinian words, they're just talk. It's just talk, and it's designed to appease the people, because at least these nations are a little smart enough to know that the people side with Palestine. That is the popular sentiment. And it's safe to say that these normalizing entities did not think that this war would go on for so long. They did not think that we would have so much time to see the hypocrisy in their stance and the difference between their words and their actions.
Absolutely. And thank you, Sister Sayyida Emin, for your wonderful analysis and contributions, and yourself as well, Sister Latifa. Always interesting as well to get it from the perspective of a Palestinian on such a key issue at a key moment. And we'd also like to thank you at home. Sadly, that is all we have time for today, but you can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. It's always nice to be with you. Thanks for coming over.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
So, in the last few episodes, we've been talking about storytelling and how we can introduce the Ahlul Bayt as the role model to our children. We've been talking about the elements that we should consider, including keeping the sentences small, syncing the body language and our tune with the story, getting the children involved in the story, let them act it out, let them make the sounds, let them narrate the story if they want, remembering that it's okay to repeat the stories a million times, they'll love it, and appreciating and acknowledging their understanding of the story without asking them directly. Now, last episode, you told us a story, and then we started discussing about how you told the story. Let's do that again. Can you please give us another sample of stories so that we can listen together and learn how to communicate with our children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Definitely. Just one point I'd like to mention before, as an introduction to the next story, is that I remember I did a few stories regarding Karbala with my children. And I did this last story of Kumail. And the question that my child asked me was, how did Kumail die? I think he was in the Muharram atmosphere, you know, the environment that everybody has to die. And his questions were always, how did this friend and this companion become Shaheed, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel that sometimes it's important to, or a lot of times it's important to also bring stories that not necessarily end up in death or end up in shahadat, right? We have a lot of stories of the Ahlul Bayt that actually are good funny stories, are stories that make you laugh or smile, or they're not always stories that end up, that narrate the madhlumiyat or the injustice that happened to the Ahlul Bayt. Yes, those stories are important as well. We need to mention those, right? About what happened, the sad stories that happened to the Ahlul Bayt. However, it's also important to mention the good things that happened to the Ahlul Bayt, right? And the funny things that happened to the Ahlul Bayt, because we have quite a few of them. So on that note, let me mention one of them that I read recently. So this is a story of a husband and a wife in the desert. They had a nice big tent out in the desert, and they used to have cattle and take care of animals, and they were living in the desert peacefully. And one day, whilst Zayd, and that's his name, the uncle's name, his name was Zayd, whilst he was looking after his sheep, suddenly he heard a noise. Ding, ding, ding. What was that? He looked around and he saw from far that the camel was approaching, and the bell of the camel was making such a noise. Ding, ding. Now, I'm sure you can make a better noise than I do. If you have a tool, if you have a bell nearby, then you can try and ring a bell as well. Anyway, let's carry on. So Zayd waited to see who was coming. He was quite anxious. Who was coming towards them right outside in the desert like this? So he was looking and he was looking and he waited. And suddenly he said, "I think Imam Ali is coming." And he had a big smile. Zayd loved to see Imam Ali come. He was so happy. He turned to his wife, "Look, look, I think Imam Ali is coming." And they were both really, really happy. I mean, all of us are really happy to see Imam Ali, aren't we? So they waited, and Amir al-Mu'mineen came right near Zayd, and he was passing by. So he told Zayd, "Salamun alaykum, Zayd." And Zayd said, "Alaykum salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen." And they had a bit of a conversation. Until Zayd noticed that Imam Ali had two bags on his horse. So he asked Amir al-Mu'mineen, "Oh Ali, what do you have in those two bags?"
I hope you're enjoying this story as much as I am. But if you want to know what's in those two bags, we're going to have to take a break. But we'll be back for the rest of the story after the break. Don't go away.
Hey, stop! I've got a favorite game!
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're listening to a very nice story as a sample of how we can narrate stories to our children from Brother Miqdad. So just before the break, there's a family who's in the desert. They have cattle, and they hear a sound. It turns out it's Amir al-Mu'mineen. They become immensely happy, and Amir al-Mu'mineen has two bags, but we still don't know what's in them.
Those two bags were small bags. They were not very big bags. So when Zayd asked Imam Ali, "What do you have in those two bags?" Imam Ali smiled and said, do you know what he said? He said, "I have date trees. I have date trees in those two bags." And Imam Ali gave a nice big kick to the camel and said, "Let's go." And he started to go forward. Now Zayd was just stunned. I'm not sure if I understood correctly. Did Imam Ali say he had trees in this bag? That doesn't make sense. He turned to his wife and told his wife, I didn't understand. Amir al-Mu'minin told me that he has trees in his bags, but those bags can't have trees. And so his wife smiled and said, think about it. I think it's good to think about things. And so she smiled as well. And Zayd just couldn't bear it. He thought about it and said, no, I don't understand. And he started to run behind Amir al-Mu'minin. He ran and he ran and ran and said, wait, 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 wait. And he was running and he was running and he was running until he reached Imam Ali. He said, Imam Ali, stop, stop, stop. So Imam Ali stopped. And he smiled at Zayd and said, what's up? And Zayd came. Zayd was huffing and he was puffing. And he says, oh, Ali, please tell me, what did you mean? I really didn't understand what you meant when you said to me that you had trees in those bags. You can't have trees in those bags. So Amir al-Mu'minin started to laugh. And he said, I have date seed in those bags. And I'm going out to the desert to plant seeds. And inshallah in the future, those seeds will become date trees. And so Zayd understood what Amir al-Mu'minin meant by that. Amir al-Mu'minin really loved to go out in the desert and plant trees and dates. And he never used to put fences around them. So everybody could come and take dates from those trees. And that would help the people a lot. They would enjoy the dates of Amir al-Mu'minin.
That was a spectacular story. Thank you very much. I personally enjoyed it a lot. I bet children are going to enjoy it a lot as well. So let's talk about a few things about this story. We have approximately a minute, and after the break we can also talk about more. I saw you you actually had literally this big smile on your face when you were talking about the moment that Amir al-Mu'minin came and everyone was happy. So you recommend that we act out this kind of facial expression?
Definitely. The children, you know, when you say a story, the children are looking at you, right? So they're staring at you, and they're not just hearing your words, but they're also looking at your face and what you're going to do, right? So the moment you have a big smile when the word Amir al-Mu'minin comes up, you know, it's an association that comes together. Mm-hmm. That whenever I hear Ali alayhi salam, I also see a bright, beautiful smile on my mom's face, on my dad's face. And that's associated together. It creates this positive association that the name of Ali alayhi salam always remained as a positive thing in my eyes.
It conveys the feeling and sentiment as well.
Exactly.
All right, let's take a break and we'll be talking about this story more after the break. Don't go away.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how to tell stories to children. And in the last two segments, Brother Maghdad told us a beautiful story about Amir al-Mu'minin. So I noticed a big smile and how you were frowning when there was a question, conveying the message of wondering something. And something very interesting that I saw is that when Zayd was running, you were running with your hands as well. And would it be like, could we like ask children to run as well to like replicate what Zayd is doing?
You could, for example, make one of the child be Zayd, for example, right? And he can pretend to be Zayd and then run and then see how he gets tired. Obviously, it depends what time of the day it is. If you're doing story time before bedtime, then you don't want them to be running before bedtime. But definitely have the hand movement there, right? And the huffing, the puffing and being out of breath because he ran so much behind Imam Ali. See, the key that I want to pass through is that you have to make it as much lively and real as possible. So you feel you're part of the story. You feel you're there seeing Zayd running behind Amir al-Mu'minin.
And I also noticed huff and puff, which is a famous expression from a story. I forgot the name of the story, actually.
It's the three pigs in the world, right?
Yeah, exactly. Using that kind of reference is also very nice to children. I mean, or was that just an accident?
It was an accident. I grew up listening to those stories.
Okay. At one point you were saying that you were making this bing sound and you said that I'm sure that you can do it better than me. Do you think that parents should be concerned about how well they replicate the sounds, or is it just not important to children?
A bit of in between, basically. Don't try to be a perfectionist and try to make the best sounds out there. I mean, it needs a lot of practice. It needs a lot of skill as well. So I don't expect all the parents out there to be able to make good bell sounds, for example, or good cow sounds, for example. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of skills. But at the same time, don't neglect it. Do make a bit of effort to make it as close as possible as you can, right? It has an effect. Children do notice it. And I promise they won't laugh at you that you made the horrible, most horrible bell sound. They might come and say, you know what, let me do it. I know how to do it better than you. That's fine, right? So that's involving the children in the stories, right? Or if you really, really don't want to do it, then say, how about you make the bell sound, right? But from the first time you're doing a story, it won't work, because the first time you do a story, the children want to be there listening only. They don't want to be involved, right? Because they don't know what's going to happen. So the first time you're doing it, definitely do it yourself first, okay? And the second, third time that they know the story, now what's going to happen, you can tell them, okay, you can do the camel's bell sound.
Yeah, it might not be very good for my profile to say this, but I remember I was once trying to make a horse sound for my niece, and I did that. Then I wanted to make a rooster sound, and I did such a terrible job at it that it was exactly like the horse sound, which is strange because they're two very different animals. But we had a very good laugh at it, of us. And another question that here in this story, the name of the character was Zaid, and we said that it's okay to change some details that don't affect the story. For parents who are living in foreign countries, would you say that it's okay that if, for instance, they use names that are more used more in the society rather than Zaid, or do you insist that it should be Zaid because we're trying to make a feeling towards the Ahlul Bayt? Because, I mean, like a parent might argue that a Robert can also be a Shia.
Let's categorize. If it's a companion that's very known and that we have a lot of things to say about, then no, definitely do not change the name. In this story, Zaid is not very relevant. You won't hear about him ever again anywhere, basically. However, I still won't recommend change names and try and adapt it to our own culture, because it comes with the environment. It comes with the whole story. And I think when they grow up and remember that there was a Robert in the Amir al-Mu'minin story, it really won't go in very well, basically. So keep it the way it is. Let children enter the world of Amir al-Mu'minin rather than trying to change that world to adapt it to our world.
Okay, thank you very much. That's not the end of our stories. We'll also be asking Brother Mughda to tell us stories in the next episode as well. But that's all the time that we have for this episode. We have to sign off. If you missed it, no worries. You can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, that's parstoday.com, and find us on the Call of Islam page. You can email us at irib.englishradio@irib.ir. That's irib.englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode and a lot of storytelling, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him,
الجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the one or two phrases of the 185th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam warns the community and the people and all those involved in the leadership from being drunk with blessings. And being drunk with blessings basically means that type of blessing, or the blessing that a person faces and achieves and has and possesses, becomes a source of forgetting their aims and objectives and goals, and sometimes also may lead a person to become sinful and evil and bad. Now, this is of course something that needs to be analyzed and has been analyzed, that the main reason is the love that a person gets of the world in their heart, and when a person is not prepared spiritually to have those blessings. As such, we should always, as believers, struggle to spiritually strengthen ourselves, as we also struggle to material progress. And this balance has to be always there, so that inshallah we are able to make use of the blessings in the right way.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, one of the things that is very important to keep in mind is a society, especially if it comes to a community, a big community like a country, or for example, a tribe, like a tribe or something like that. If we have a community like that, then it is very crucial that the leadership purifies itself from these false attachments to the world. And the leadership and those people in authority at different levels should not have that kind of, you can say, drunkenness with worldly and material issues. Because what happens is one of the reasons why a community or a people or citizens begin to dislike their leaders and their elders is when they see and notice that the leaders and elders are just focused and fixated on their own material progress. And sometimes they might not be like that, but when people see that they're just becoming rich and richer, then they might have a misconception in their minds. You know, sometimes a leader, or for example, a person in leadership might suddenly get some wealth, for example, as an inheritance or something like that.
Still, he needs to be careful because people can have different types of interpretations. And therefore, in order for the leadership and the governing group to be loved by the people, they need to try to achieve a simpler lifestyle. Does that mean that we need our aims should to be simple? The reason why we should be simple is to attract the love of the people. Is that the reason why we should do actions? Of course not. We should do actions only to please Allah. But when we notice that if we become affluent in this way and we start to spend in ways that are not good or overspend as leaders of a community for our own personal, let's say, gains and personal, material progress, then people become disoriented. People, they start to get doubts and confused.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Nahjul Balagha, translated as the Peak of Eloquence, is a compilation of sermons, letters, and sayings that reflected Imam Ali's profound insights on governance, ethics, spirituality, and social justice. Sayyid Razi's meticulous work in preserving and presenting Imam Ali's words has made Nahjul Balagha a timeless source of inspiration for scholars, theologians, and seekers of wisdom.
Now, as those people that have experience in leadership and governance, they will tell you that people, you need always the support of the people to be able to progress in your aims and objectives. That includes an Islamic system also. If there is an Islamic system, the aim of that Islamic system is to uphold the values of Islam. And in order for those values to be upheld, people need to be there to support the government. People need to be there to uphold those values. What happens is that when there is a society, when there is a group of people in the leadership, or in a, for example, in the structure, in the government structures, that start to, for example, maybe become a bit corrupt here and there, and they start to become wealthy in ways that are not clear, people start to become disoriented, disenchanted, and therefore you will see that their support will also wane. So what should these groups of people do? They need to focus on serving. When they focus on serving, then you'll notice that people will see the fruits and the results of their service. People will notice the simplicity of their lifestyle, and they will love that particular leadership and those particular groups of people. And alhamdulillah, if you notice, our ulama, our maraji, look at how simple they live. And this simplicity in their lifestyle is what has caused the people to love and always be attached to these systems. And we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that all the other systems that are in various places of the of the Islamic world, they purge out those corrupt elements, and we are able to see a pure group of people leading the communities towards the goals and objectives that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put in place. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Conversation.
Hello, I'm Jim Gibney, and welcome to a special edition of The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs around Ireland. This week, we take a look at the 1981 hunger strike. Much has been written about this tumultuous period in our history. But one area which has not received much attention is the communication system used by both the leadership of Sinn Féin on the outside and the prisoners on the inside. So let's introduce today's guests. Joining me today is Tom Hartley, who was in charge of the POW department and organised the communication system from the outside. I'm also joined today by former political prisoner Sheena Walsh, who can speak authoritatively about the communication from inside the H blocks during the hunger strike of 1981. And firstly then, over to Tom. So Tom, first of all, why was there a communication system needed and when did you put it together? When did you organise it?
Well, of course, the prison authorities done all in their power to close down the communications between the prisoners and the outside. And that meant, of course, that there wasn't a flow and it was often difficult to get information in and out of the jail. And, of course, men were, and women in the Armagh, they were locked away. They were on strike. They were on the no wash. And all of that, these conditions made it difficult to have a flow of information in and out of the jail, or indeed all of it made it difficult to have a flow of communications. So I was appointed head of the POW department sometime, I think about, was 1979-1980. And of course, the context for all of this is a very deepening crisis in the Hayes blocks in Armagh Women's Prison. And so I was appointed as the chair of the POW department. And the first thing I set myself to do was to create a communications between us outside and the prisoners inside. Because it was obvious that we needed a flow of information. Because the period we were going through was, you know, it was a deep political crisis.
When you say a crisis, what exactly do you mean in terms of the how many prisoners were you dealing with on the inside in the Hayes blocks and in Armagh Women's Prison?
Well, I think by that time there was a few hundred. Remember, there was always an increasing number of prisoners and it was never a static number. And so you had the prisoners in the H blocks and the women in Armagh Jail. And but what was really going on was this big, you know, crisis inside the jails. It was really imperative that the leadership outside had an understanding of the conditions inside, what the Republican prisoners were enduring, what was happening to them, you know, and what was happening to them on a daily basis. So I went then to see Maura McCrory, and Maura was in charge of the Relatives Action Committee. And so I explained to Maura what was required in terms of communication. Now, Maura then went to the Relatives Action Committee, and the Relatives Action Committee was made up of the girlfriends, mothers, sisters, grandmothers of the prisoners. And so Maura then brought me back a list of those who were going in to visit. So that was really the start of a process where we could determine who was going to what block, who was going to Armagh, and then we started to build this communication network with the prisoners. And in time, of course, the prisoners then sent us the what visits they were taking. So, in fact, there was a coordinated approach between ourselves and the prisoners to create this flow of information and flow of comms in and out of the jails.
That might be a good point to bring Shane in to explain from the inside, the prison point of view, why it was important that there was this flow of information from inside to outside.
I would have to actually go back a wee bit because whenever the protest started in September 76 with Kieran Nugent, the vast majority of the prisoners who ended up in the protest refused to take visits because it meant that you would have to wear a prison uniform. So what that then meant was that people didn't know what was happening outside because our letters were being censored, heavily censored, and any information that we could get out usually was word of mouth through the priests who were coming in. Or when we shared it across, you met people from, if you had to go to the hospital or you had to go on appeals or, you know, to go back to court, things like that. That is the only time that you would actually come across other prisoners and be able to get the word out. So it was late 77, early 78, when Brenton Hughes and the team came down from the cages, having lost their status as a result of an incident that happened, a bit of a row with the prison warders in the cages. And they landed down into the blocks. And one of the first things that the dark made clear to people was that people outside didn't know what was going on inside the prisons. They didn't know about the brutality and the deprivation that we were enduring. And so he also initiated a discussion and a debate about the future of the protest. And that actually started then on March 1978. What actually happened was when we took the decision to take visits, it meant that you were coming into more and more contact with the prison warders. And the prison warders resented the fact that we were taking visits, and they stepped up the harassment and the brutality, which then led in turn to us beginning to escalate the protests within the jail, which in turn led to further escalation of the brutality. And we ended up on the No Wash protest. We used to take visits with a simple objective of getting the word out of what was happening within the prisons. It was only later then that we decided that we were going to have to organise it in some better fashion, because initially it was very haphazard. You took visits whenever you wanted to take them or whenever it suited your family. We decided that we would have to start taking a more strategic approach to it, because we needed to spread the visits out, whereby we were trying to cover every single day that there would be visits out from every wing and visits, you know, making contact with not only our visitors, but also making contact with prisoners from the other blocks.
So there's an awareness on the inside that there has to be a much more coordinated approach to get the information outside to Tom and to the party leadership. And then, so Tom, what then happens with this system? You've got a group of women who are basically organized around yourself. What then begins to take shape in terms of the structure of the communication
system?
First
of all, it's a very simple system. You know, there's nothing extraordinary about it other than there were visits, and then the prisoners were sending out their information, and we were sending in information. So once that was established, that really took off and just worked on its own. And that was a pattern, you know, that's right through the hunger strikes and right beyond the hunger strikes that this communication trail was established and then worked. But from early on, certainly when I started to communicate with the prisoners, one of the first things I did was to send in a note, quite a lengthy note, to say, look, you need then to start to write to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Pope, the Taoiseach, your GAA clubs, your youth clubs, your women's movement, any social connection that was in existence needed to get a note or a letter from a H-block prisoner or a woman in Armagh. And in essence, what then happened was, so prisoners, of course, were on the inside, you might say, you know, really at the coalface of the struggle. But then the role as communicating their conditions to the outside world really externalized the role, you know. So it wasn't that this was an internalized role of prisoners by and large watching what was happening to their comrades in hunger strike. I think suddenly prisoners had this very structured view of what they needed to do to inform the world. You know that old Republican saying, it's no use doing it if you don't tell the world. So the prisoners told the world by the sending out their comms.
So Shana, in terms of inside the prison, who was coordinating that huge effort that Tom is describing?
Well, it would actually have to go back before the hunger strikes again, and in the sense that late 79, there was a push on by the prisoners for a hunger strike. It was actually at the time of the Pope visiting Ireland. In October 79, the Pope came. But before that, there had been the intention to launch a hunger strike. And what then happened was that after some very forthright discussion with the leadership on the outside, they agreed to defer the protest, the hunger strike, and to engage in a whole propaganda campaign, basically, of information, as relayed by Tom there. That we then began to write to everybody that we could think of. Trade unions, GAA groups, credit union organisations, community groups, anybody who we thought would give us an ear. We also wrote to all sorts of politicians, both foreign and domestic. We wrote to any sort of big personalities. Like I remember Bobby Sands talking about writing to Jane Fonda, and Jane Fonda actually made some comment in one of the Sunday papers about receiving this call from the prisons in Ireland and in Loughcash. So we really sort of got stuck into that from about 1979, late 1979.
In terms of then, because obviously, I think Shana was saying that there was phases to this. You know, there's this what he called the propaganda phase leading up to the hunger strike. And at that stage, the flow of information from your end into the prison was routine and in a way casual. But as the situation deteriorates in the prison, you then have the hunger strike of 1980 looming. What then happens to the system, the communication system?
Well, let me explain then how the communications were handled outside. First of all, we would send a communication in at 9:30 in the morning, and we're able to get an answer out by 12:30. And then we were able to send another communication in at about 2:00 and get a reply now by, 4:00 or 4:30. And that was fairly standard, you know. Once that was established, that was the pattern, you know. So we had very good communications. And then as we developed and as the crisis developed, there was small crystal radios sent in. Now, they were so small, but the benefit of the crystal radio was that the blocks were beside the BBC mast at Blair's, so they could pick up the news. So right. That was a help to them. So they were able to hear what was taking place, say, at 11:00 news at night. That was also an aid. Then we decided that we would miniaturise the Amphiblact. And they were about that size, and they were sent in. So there was an intense level of communication going in. Now, what would happen? There was, at one level, there was thousands of communications coming out, and we could not handle all the communications. So generally, we handled the communications to the leadership of Sinn Féin coming out, and we had a room in 51 Falls Road. And so as the communications came out, they would all be sorted. And then we had a team that would write out and then type out on small brown sheets of paper what was in the comm. And these would be presented to the leadership.
You know, one of the things that I always think about is the quote from Pat Sheehan. Pat Sheehan was on the hunger strike for 55 days. He was the longest prisoner on the hunger strike whenever the hunger strike was ended on the 3rd of October in 1981. And Pat talks about whenever he put his name down to go on the hunger strike, that he received a call from the IRA, from the Army Council of the IRA. And what it stated on the comm, on the cover of the comm, the address of the comm, it said on it, Oglach Pat Sheehan. And Pat was saying that, you know, the only time you ever see a reference to Oglach anybody is on a gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this had a very profound effect upon him when he received this comm from the council.
And do you recall the crystal radios coming into the prison? Was there one in your wing?
The crystal radios, the introduction of the crystal radios was massive in the blocks, because up until then, the news that we got was through the visits or the sort of weekly news that you would have got from the Republican News, whenever we were able to smuggle in. And the crystal sets really changed all that, in that you were able to get a daily news every night. Now, as we got further into the hunger strike, and particularly as the situation became more and more intense, guys used to listen to the radios during the day. So you have cases where, and it was very dangerous to do that, in the sense that the prison warders could come and open your door at any time. But we were so hungry for news, so eager to keep on top of what was happening to our comrades in the hospitals. listening to any news of the various initiatives that we were getting. Tom has talked about the external groups who were coming up with ways of how to solve the hunger strike in terms of the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace. There was a delegation of Southern MEPs came in. There were people come in from the Swiss Red Cross guys came in and visited us at one stage with, looking at different ways to resolve it. There was a constant flow of bishops and, the Pope actually sent an emissary across to try and resolve the hunger strike. So all of this was happening, and it was very important that we were able to listen to any of the developments as they were happening, not only what they were saying when they came into the jail, but what they were saying when they left the jail.
And what was the background to the crystal sets? Do you remember?
So an old comrade of mine, Shawnee McVeigh, who RIP, who were both knew each other, he came up with the idea of, can we get some sort of a radio in the jail? Surely there's some sort of a radio with miniaturized batteries that you could get in and you could listen to the news and keep abreast of how things are going. And he mentioned this to a good friend of ours, Arthur Fagan. And Arthur, while he didn't have the wherewithal to produce this radio, he knew a guy who did. And he approached this guy and he spoke to him, and they came up with this crystal set. And the beauty of the crystal set was that it didn't need batteries. It worked, and I still don't know how it worked. But it worked by connecting one wire to the grill on the window, and the second wire was connected to the hot water pipes, the heating pipes in the cell. And there was an earpiece which fitted into your ear, and through that, as Tom said, you were able to pick up a signal from Glarus BBC mast.
And did the communication system itself, did it make an intolerable situation on the inside easier to manage? The knowledge that people knew on the outside what was happening to you before the hunger strike began?
Well, it meant that what we were enduring was made known to people outside in general. The idea of suffering in silence may well be something to be admired, but it wasn't what the protest was about. And I think it was Tom said earlier on that there's an Irish saying that there's no sense in doing something if you don't tell the world about it.
And remember, Jim, if you're not seen, you're not heard. And the cobs were the manifestation of prisoners being seen.
And just finally then on the importance of the comms. And I think in this book, 10 Men Dead, by David Beresford, the book is based on the comms that survive on the outside, and the story about the hunger strike, hunger strikes in Armagh Women's Prison, both hunger strikes in the H blocks, and the deaths of the 10 lads are reflected in this book. So you can see the importance of them in that regard. But I was just wondering, just what happened to the comms, the ones that survived? Where are they today?
The bulk of them are in the National Library in Dublin.
Yes, and they will be available to be seen at some point?
Yes, but they're being, I think, digitised at the minute because they're in a very vulnerable state because they're very flimsy, but they'd be in a very... But they tell their own story of, what was going on. But they also, when you read them, tell the story of the attitude of prisoners, of their morale, of their sense of themselves as a group. There's so many dimensions of the H-Block and Armagh story that are contained in those comms.
And I suppose when reading the comms, and then when you read Beresford's book and the comms, you see the intensity and also the bravery and heroism of the prisoners in the H-Blocks and Armagh Women's Prison in the most difficult circumstances and what they're experiencing.
And oddly, one of the things comes across very strong is the humanity of the prisoners, because the humour that is contained in those comms,
you know, and it could be often described as black humor,
yeah.
But it's truly amazing, you know, and it's not of a defeated group, anything, but it's people with ideas, people with a vision, you know, it's they have a sense of their purpose, and it all comes through in the comms.
And the comms recorded those period, that period, that historic period in our history.
Well, the comms did indeed record that whole period from start to finish and even beyond. But one of the things you have to realise too is that all of the comms did not survive in the way that Tom's talking about there in the National Museum.